Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard to today's edition of Human Events Daily. What we're doing during this holiday break season, this Christmas break season, as I've told everybody, we're doing these one-on-one interviews, kind of just be able to sit down with people, pick their brains about what's going on in the world, and really make something that's just kind of an evergreen content that people could listen to at any time. And though, unfortunately for you guys, I do have to apologize because I said we were going to pick their brains, but right now we're interviewing James Lindsay. So, of course, you know, it's probably going to be a very short episode. Because we don't have a lot of material to work with there. But, you know, we've got James Lindsay, the Dark Lord, the evil id of Twitter, author of Cynical Theories. And then you guys have a new version of it out, right?
Yeah, we have a new version called Social Injustice coming out next month.
Oh, it's coming out next month.
Yeah.
So, and that's sort of like an abridged. Explain the difference between what the original book is and then what this is.
So the original book is written probably at like a late college, early graduate school kind of level of scholarship.
It was very hard for me to get through that one.
Yeah, that one's a little harder. This one's easy reading. It's the same arguments, the same case that we make, and it's summarized, it kind of boiled down to its simplest essence. Take a lot of the difficult, clunky scholarship, the long block quotes and things out, so that you can just get the meat without having to...
Well, no, what I actually did like about the book, and I think the last time I saw you, you gave me a copy of it, and what I liked about it is you've gone to such a... Like, you are inside their minds at this point in terms of you know more about critical race theory and where it's come from than the people who are the critical race theorists at this point. And what you've done in that, it's a compendium is the way I looked at it, as you have the research all there. So when someone says, oh, that's not real, or, oh, that's not a thing, it's boom, page 56, boom,
yeah.
page 102, boom, it's all there.
I actually have a funny story, if you don't mind to tell us a funny story. I got invited to go on the Dr. Phil show over the summer, and it's supposed to come out
like the Dr. Phil.
Yeah, that guy. And so
I've heard he's not nice, by the way.
Well, I interacted with him so much that's what I heard too.
Oh, really?
And so, but I interacted with him personally.
I'm not nice to my staff either.
I know you wouldn't be. That's why I like you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Harassment, etc. Very important.
I swear.
No,
shaming.
But he grabbed my shoulder as he walked out. That's it. So I have no idea. I didn't talk to the guy. But no, he
was he aiming somewhere else?
No, he was.
Unfortunately.
And I couldn't tell if it was a very exasperated thing because I went on there and like went off. Like, I went berserk. It's epic.
Wait, so this already happened?
This was in August.
I feel like I would have seen if you were on...
It comes out on January 5th.
Comes out
they
on January 5th.
They sat on that 5th. A little while,
didn't
they?
So wait, they... And let me just get the time straight. They did this interview all the way back in August. Does he do that normally? Does
no,
he interview...
No, they told us
does
2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah. Because I would say, you know, usually...
They sat on this one a while.
Like, this interview, even though, you know, like I just said in the intro here, we're doing these because... You know, actually, even though I am mean to my staff, I did kind of want to give them, you know, a little bit of a break over Christmas. And then so we're doing the, but it's going to come out next week. It's not, you know, I'm going to sit on it forever.
Yeah. So anyway, he brought out a CRT expert, right?
Right. So on the show.
Yeah. Sean Harper at USC, professor there. And the guy's like saying all this stuff. And what was really evil, he brought out the professor. Then he started bringing out moms and dads against critical race theory and let the professor shoot him down and embarrass him. And, you know, I was sitting backstage. Yeah, I didn't get brought out to the end.
Oh, so you're not out yet.
Yeah, and I was getting, like,
you're just watching this.
It's like, because it's so garbage. And so this guy's either lying or wrong, one or the other. I don't know which.
But I guarantee he's probably doing it with, you know, the condescension and that sort overconfidence, overbearing.
Yeah, yeah.
I know all. I know better.
Like he was sitting up on his perch.
I am professor.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And you are some, you know, rube. Grimy grit under your you know toenails kind of rube. How dare you question the professor?
How dare you?
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah,
so
yeah.
When I came out, instead of like Dr. Phil's like, well, what would you do? You know, he asked some question, and I was like, I'm not going to answer that. And I went off, and I just started calling out the professor for his lies. I was like, you said it wasn't 1989, but if you're a real critical race theorist, you know that the founding conference was at a convent off the side of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And it was in 1989, you know, and it's like, you said this, but this on page whatever of, you know, page 19 of Ibram Kendi says this, and it just bam, 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 one thing after another. So, yeah, you're right. I kind of know it better than they do.
Was he still on at that point, or had he
dipped off? Oh, yeah, he was having like a fit. He was there just like,
oh, I got to watch this.
Oh, I don't know how they're going to cut it, but I'm assuming badly for me.
Right, well, and that's one of the things that I've learned with stuff like that I've done Because I had a, I actually was on Joy Reid, you know, years ago at one point, like on a panel.
Oh, yeah.
And they kind of like planned me and they said, oh, we just need like a guy from Philly who's kind of conservative. I said, I'll do it. You know, and I started up. She did not like that I actually knew LBJ's actual civil rights record.
Oh, wow.
Then she's like, no, LBJ, civil rights. He's the one. He drove for it. He was the champion. And I'm like, well, yeah, maybe after, you know, after Dealey Plaza, but prior to then, not so much.
Not so much.
Not so much. And I just start going, it's like, and I'm not even making an argument whether it's good or not. I'm just saying, like you just said, like, that's not the history. When he was a congressman, he was against it. When he was a senator, he was really against it. He participated in the filibuster with Al Gore's father. Yep. I mean, this is just history. It's just basic history.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, I knew it all off the top of my head. I didn't even know we were going to talk about that
stuff. Yeah, it goes rough when that happens, you know.
Yeah, they don't like it.
No.
No, they don't like it. And you know what's funny is that not only has she not invited me back, she blocked me on Twitter the other day.
How pleasant.
Well, it's annoying, though, because I don't even think that I wasn't even tweeting at Joy Reid at that point.
Well,
so I don't even know where that even came from.
Maybe she's watching you.
Well, I watch her every night. That
Oh, well.
Is the only one. Look, I know a lot of people like Tucker. For me, Joy Reid is the only show, I kid you not, I will watch that every single night religiously. Because
well,
she
sense.
Is the gift that keeps on giving.
Correct. That's right. It's why I tell everybody that my favorite critical race theorist of all time is Robin DiAngelo.
Yeah.
Because she just spills it out. And
exactly.
It's like obvious, like, okay, so you're a white racist lady. You're clearly mentally ill. Like, she just says it, you
right?
know? It's like you're clearly
just
struggling.
There, like, you're like, so, all right. We said we were going to have like an actual interview. We should probably do that at some point.
Yeah, we have to pick my brain.
Right, the brain picking. The right. So what I wanted to ask you was because I know you've done so much great work talking about this. And, well, maybe we'll do that at first. But, you know, give us in a nutshell, how did we get here? How did critical race theory go from this rinky-dink conference in the 1980s up to, like, taking over the military, taking over the heads, the minds of the Pentagon, U.S. military, you know, the greatest, most powerful military in the world, and they're what? They're paying attention to this stuff that's,
yeah.
like, barely a couple of decades old? You know, this wasn't exactly, you know, the founding fathers or Enlightenment thinkers or, you know, Edmund Burke or,
yeah.
or any of this stuff, right? Or even Clausewitz, right?
Yeah.
You know, Total War. No, none of that. No, or Lind on 4G warfare. No, none of that. No, we're going to listen to critical race theory. How do we get from that to this?
There's three primary components, really. The first is what you hear as a so-called long march to the institution. So
sure.
This was all bubbling up within the universities and kind of what that does is that, you know, the educational pillar of society connects to all the other pillars. Where you're going to get your media people? You're going to get them out of educated media or to educated people that went to the university. Where are you going to get your politicians? Out of fancy finishing schools like Harvard. Where are you going to get your future teachers? Out of the university. So by
there used to be this idea, though, that, you know, oh, well, we understand that the professors are crazy, but when people graduate and they get to the work pool and they realize what real life is like, they'll just shake that off. But that
right.
didn't happen, did it?
Well, it turned out, so that's point number one, and that's the neo-Marxist plan to stop being radicals in the street and get into K-12 education and to get into the university system and to take over education on both levels. So that's coming out of the 60s, early 70s. And what happened by the end of the 70s, the primary target they shot for was schools of education. So the primary thing they sought to take over was how we teach our kids and what we teach our kids. Starting by the early 1980s, they had almost full control over the colleges of education in terms of what curriculum is going to come out, what education is going to focus on, and they started working more and more very strategically of this what they call critical pedagogy in. What that does is think of like a field or whatever, right? If you want to grow corn in the field, you got to plow the soil first. You got to
right.
prepare it. By teaching the teachers, they were basically putting the plows in the hands and getting the kids of the next generation primed for this change. And then those people grow up, go to university, become teachers, and they plow the soil even better. And they finally get the soil prepared so that the revolution can burst forth. The third component is big money interests realize its utility, especially after the Occupy Wall Street movement. They watched the banks kind of sweat it out, 2011 or so. Sweating it out, Occupy is this huge thing. It's actually crossing party boundaries. It's not just a left-wing movement. A lot of people thought it was, but a lot of right-wing guys were looking at this and were like, no, the banks are a big part of the problem. We'll lend support and help this out too.
Well, and this is where Bitcoin was not really a left-wing thing when it started.
Right.
It was more like a libertarian thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this was kind of like fleshing out, and the banks were like, basically send in the intersectionalists. You talk to the guys that were involved in Occupy that were the organizers, a lot of them were white guys, and they said, you know, by a year or two in, it got so frustrating. Everything had to be, no, only black women get to speak, or only black women get to speak first.
Right,
you just
right,
have
right,
white
right.
white privilege. And the banks realized that this would melt this thing down. And then all these other big financial interests were like, this is the tool. And they started dumping grant money into it, just by the millions and billions. You know, how did we get so much critical race theory in education? Well, starting about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, somewhere in that range, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation started dumping tons and tons of money in it. The same professor I mentioned on Dr. Phil. Go to his CV. I looked it up on, it's on his website, on his university website. Click on his CV.
Oh, they love posting CV. All four or five pages.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
They're all so excited about
like,
how long
you know,
it is. You
it's
know.
All my grants. And it's like, Bill and Melinda Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates. It's like, this guy, Bill and Melinda Gates have given this guy millions of dollars over the years.
But they just want to give back.
No, they want to make use of the tool that they found that works really, really well, that breaks up any movement that might look at their vest, you know, big power interests,
right.
Especially those being tied to the financial industry.
And I've seen this a lot lately, and we talk about this, and I did a whole book on Antifa, and we touched on this from a different perspective, but the idea that, you know, and I said it the last time I was doing a podcast with actually with Alex Clark, who's also here at Turning Point, and I said, you know, it's funny enough, like Occupy was kind of right about a lot of the things
exactly.
they were talking about,
exactly.
at least economically. And, you know, of course, we didn't listen because it didn't seem like it was coming from people who could be right about that. But then once we did see the power of the big banks and Wall Street, we realized that by the time we had figured it out, the people who had been there had flipped. And now somehow, you know, by hook and by crook, they're on the same side as BlackRock and Bank of America and Citigroup. And we're sitting there scratching our heads going, wait. Klaus Schwab is out there talking about the great reset.
That's the key
and,
right there.
And, you know, and we must build back better, which is, of course, the slogan of the great reset. I don't know if people realize that when they combine the two. And that, because it wasn't just, you know, the Biden administration pushing build back better. This was going through Boris Johnson. It was coming out of Davos. I don't know if you just saw, but they just canceled the next Davos. I'm so sorry. Because
that's,
of COVID.
Oh, that's a shame. Just, Omakouf comes in handy,
oh,
finally.
Oh, no, Omakouf. Yeah, fine. The silver lining.
Silver lining
I also
of
saw that all of Broadway got shut down. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Womp.
Sad trombone.
Exactly. And so we didn't plan that, by the way. So, you know, you have all these stuff going on, and yet you've got these guys who are, you know, fight the power, fight the rage against the machine, right?
Yeah, right.
Fight the power, right? It's like, but fight for the power.
But for the real power.
For the real power. Yeah. No. It's like, no, these are like the actual fascists, right?
That's right.
And you're like on the side. I don't understand it.
Right. Well, the World Economic Forum has been grooming these people for decades. They've got an agenda. The Great Reset's been planned for a long time. And, you know, they've always wanted to have the various elements that they were going to use to create the Great Reset. It's going to require societal chaos and so on. And again, they discover the power of identity politics and they start moving their metrics. ESG, for example, the environmental, social, and governance metrics that they use to decide who can get investments, whose portfolios get
which is
what,
essentially
you know,
what I call it is it's a corporate social credit
it
score.
Is. A, that's exactly what
I,
it
that's
is.
That's all
it's
I say.
Corporate
it's,
social
it,
credit
it's,
score.
Yeah, because you can go through an ESG and it means this.
Sure,
and
sure.
It's,
nope.
It's they took the model out of the CCP
that's right.
of the social credit score and they made it, they corporatized it. And so you don't need legislation for this
exactly.
anymore. You don't need any ruling. You don't need, you know, Biden doesn't have to issue an executive order. No. This is where BlackRock essentially becomes the operations arm of the Fed.
That's right.
Right. So the Fed prints the money. They give it to their buddies at BlackRock and Blackstone and others, then go out and they're going to sprinkle it around the community. Okay, you're going to get investment. You're going to get some VC cash. You're going to get this. And it's all fake. It's all the money of the people, right? And which is pumping up the inflationary pressures that we're seeing now. But it's also the idea of, but before you can get those investments, right? Because you got these boomers like Larry Fink, these liberal boomers
yep.
who are sitting there going and saying, well, if we can just push these values a little bit more,
exactly.
you know,
exactly.
this will, you know, and that's actually where I'm kind of like, it just in my thinking and my research on this, is how much of it is Larry Fink actually just believes he's doing the right thing, and how much of it is Larry Fink is doing what's good for his bottom line?
Yeah, that I can't answer anybody's,
you know,
personal
what I mean,
motivations.
Right?
Yeah, but that's a problem. But what are these values we can very clearly see? Environmental, social, and governance. And so social is where all of these critical social theories
yes.
gained dominance. They saw the utility of these things to make the kind of conditions that they can operate in optimally. It sells to the public well. It gives them this kind of, oh, we're caring about the new version of the civil rights movement, which has tremendous social cash throughout the entire West. Everybody since the 1960s has been pretty positive about civil rights developments. And so they know that that's like the so-called right side of history. And so these critical social theories that are in, like, critical race theory, gender theory, et cetera, are tucked into that S score. And so they were able to start using this corporate social credit system that's been in place for a long time now to start pushing these values simultaneously, to give grants and start directing people who were doing that to go further down that road and further down that road. So it's all kind of tied together, but they saw the utility of this thing to cause massive social disruption that keeps their advantage present.
So this, by the way, this is where
these fools are using the woke.
Right. And this is also kind of what a lot of people don't see, is that a lot of these companies, particularly the publicly traded ones, they're not constituted to be in the process of selling widgets, selling products, people don't understand. They're constituted to prop up their stock value.
That's right.
For the stock. And so that's why a lot of people, when they hear get woke, go broke, they think, oh, well, anything woke will fail. And it does, but at the same time, they don't care. They don't care that, you know, people aren't going to spend $100 million on this movie, because BlackRock controls $9 trillion.
Exactly, that's right.
And that pot of money, because that's all they're looking at, that pot of money versus consumer cash, they don't care if a movie flops. That's why Netflix can make 1 million movies a year that nobody watches, because they're valuing it on their books, and then that goes to the stock price, so they're going to get more money.
That's exactly right. ROI is completely irrelevant, because it's all about how those investment portfolios get managed and traded, and that's where the real money generation is happening, which gives those corporations, those entities, tremendous amounts of power to jerk around all the other corporations along whatever vision, social vision they might have.
I was talking to a buddy of mine who is a political consultant in Pennsylvania and who shall remain nameless, right? But he was talking to a potential business that wanted to work with him, wanted to do some like, you know, Harrisburg lobbying type stuff. And he was explaining to him this whole process.
Yeah.
And he had said, and because they are publicly traded, small company. And they said, you know, it's the weirdest thing, but every year BlackRock comes in, buys 10% of the company, never talks to us, never on the calls, sells it, then they're gone for a while, then they come back, they buy it again, and then they're gone again. And then he said, well, why do you think they do that? And he said, well, I think it has to do with the ESG score. What's that? And my buddy's sitting there listening to it. Here's the explanation. And at the end of it, he goes, so you just go along with it?
Yeah.
And they say, we want the money.
Yep, that's what it comes down to. I mean, you hear that on the macroscopic scale like that, and the microscopic scale too. With all the stuff that's creeping into medicine, the woke medicine, I hear from doctors all the time saying, well, I know this stuff's wrong, but I got a practice to build. What am I going to do?
Right.
And so they want the money. They want... you know, whatever access that they can get. And we're seeing this replicated at every level. And the top level, the big key, is this social credit score run by these kind of big investment firms. I keep saying that it's like they've got the cart and the horse. And, you know, they're the horse pulling the cart. And the cart is full of all this fascistic garbage that's going to ruin everybody's freedom. And the link that's holding the two together, the chain, the one link of the chain that's holding together, is called ESG. It's got ESG printed on that link. That's the thing that has to be looked at and broken and challenged, and alternatives have to be given, et cetera. Like, I guess Warren Buffett's not on board. Berkshire Hathaway's not on board with the ESG stuff.
Really? I didn't know
that. As far as I know, I only saw a little bit about it. But
yeah, but I have seen Charlie Munger out there talking about how much he loves China's system at the same time.
Well, that's probably not good either.
Yeah, so, right. You know, it is, because what he's talking about essentially is state capitalism, right?
Of course.
And he was talking about how, and people forget, what was it when it came to Jack Ma? The founder of Alibaba, who essentially created these you know, it's the eBay on steroids. This is like eBay of the world, you know, connecting each little product that's made in China with the rest of the world so you can get the distributors connected. And oh, I've been to like the actual Alibaba like facilities in Zhejiang, China, where, you know, you can go in and like this little kiosk and they only sell erasers, you know, or this one only sells, because you never wonder like where that stuff comes from. But I've actually been there. I've seen it. I've been to Foxconn. I've seen the suicide nets, all that. And when it comes to Jack Ma, he was allowed to do all of those things.
Yeah.
But what was it that crossed the line? When he got into banking.
That's right.
It was when he got into personal banking.
That's right. That's right. And so...
And then Munger loved it. Munger said, and they scooped him up, and they took him away, and then he... And I love this interview. I think it was might have been ABC or NBC. I think it was ABC. And he goes, you know what? I think that we should have that... And he catches himself, and he goes, well, maybe part of that system here in the U.S.
And so this is the creepy part, though, is what you have to... Like, BlackRock's creating this ESG thing, and, you know...
Yes.
And you think, okay, whatever. But then... So much of their assets are held in China, where ESG doesn't apply.
Precisely.
So they're creating a system that they're.
But China has a form of ESG.
Well,
right?
They do.
And it's just ESG under their terms.
Right. It's a CCP ESG or something.
Right. Right. CCP ESG. You're right. So it's the same idea of it's like. Darren Beatty has this phrase, taboo arbitrage, right? Where, you know, there are taboos in the United States, but there are taboos in China. So, you know, you can talk about certain things in China that you can't talk about in the United States.
Right.
And then, but, you know, and you can't go to China and be talking about things like democracy or freedom of speech or the flourishing of ideas, this type of thing. But you can talk about, you can talk about any of, like, this potential thought crime type of things you're not allowed to talk about in the U.S. without fear of getting canceled. And so... They were the ones who really drove right down that path of creating a form of state capitalism. And I saw this when I worked in the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, that we would bring people in, delegates from the U.S., politicians and businessmen, and they would come in. And I remember the whole opening up of China was, it's going to be great, and they're going to become more liberalized, and they're going to be democratic. Just you wait. Just a couple of more minutes, and they're going to be democratic, and they're going to be voting, and they're going to come back with Taiwan, and it's all going to be great, and it's going to be, you know, horseshoes and rainbows, and Hong Kong is going to teach them, you know, financial capitalism is going to lead to liberal democracy, et cetera. And it was the exact opposite, because every time I brought Americans over, and I saw, I mean, I was, you know, like a junior guy there, but I would see the Americans come over, and they say, huh, so you want to build a maglev train, and there's people in the way. What do you do? We make them not in the way anymore.
Yeah, we move them.
They're gone.
Yeah.
What about when you have the houses that have been there, Shirkuman, ancient, you know, Chinese-style houses that have been made for so many years that are just these historical pieces, but you want to put up a new shopping mall.
Yeah.
They're
What's
gone.
The problem? You've heard of bulldozers,
What's
right?
What's the problem? You just bulldoze it. They're very weak, and they don't stay together, and poor construction. So you just take them down, and then you build it up.
Exactly.
What's the issue with that? And they get drunk with the power.
Yeah.
They get drunk with the power of having that level of control, that level of, and what it is, it's authoritarianism.
Sure.
At the end of the day, under a different name, state capital, all this stuff. And so I think that in many ways, ESG is our version of state capitalism coming in that they learned from China.
Absolutely. And there's a more sinister and cynical interpretation of how all of that went down. What caused the opening of China? Who was behind that? Well, you got Kissinger and et cetera coming over. So what if
Kissinger, who's writing books with Schmidt about transhumanism now, right? It's
so,
like, you follow this guy.
So
you know?
Imagine if you make the monster that you're then going to have to defeat later, right? So you create the beast and say, oh no, look at this beast. The only way, and what do you hear from people like the World Economic Forum and so on? Well, if we want to be able to beat China, we have to become like China. You heard this from Biden.
Right, and you actually hear this in so many ways, and people will say, like, why is everyone's favorite Hungarian billionaire anti-China and anti-CCP? And you realize, and on one hand, it's kind of part of the Game of Thrones of, you know, I want to protect my interests, I want power, you're going to take my power. But it's also that, well, we've got to do this great reset if we want to compete with China. It's the only way. We've got to implement this stuff. We've got to take away private ownership. We've got to lead to more, you know, BlackRock has to own the houses. You guys are going to be more of a Russian serf class, a renter class. But don't worry, because you'll be happy. And, oh, by the way, you'll be plugged into Zuckerverse and Neuralink and everything else. And you'll be totally fine. It's not that you won't own anything. It's that you'll own, you know, a massive palatial 5,000 square foot house in Zucker world, right? You know, floating in space
exactly.
somewhere. While you're at home being plugged in, getting your 25th booster, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so our favorite billionaire over there, you know, also has a vision, if we take him at his word, of an open society.
Right.
And so China doesn't have an open society, so China's not on his list of great places, which is probably why the Chinese government named him a terrorist recently. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, no, I do. Yeah.
So, you know, there's this weird, you say Game of Thrones, but there's this really weird competition going on way up at the top there now, where strange things are now in motion.
Well, I call it, you know, we talk of sort of like the deep state, right, a lot, this sort of a compression, but we also have to think of the terms of, in terms of the overstate,
yeah.
Right? And so this is your sort
exactly.
of your oligarch level. This is, you know, they're the people that are moved. We can see the chess pieces being moved around,
yeah.
But these are the people actually holding the chess pieces and then deciding,
exactly.
Okay, I'm going to make this move. I'm going to move against Xi, and you didn't think I was going to do that, but now here it is, and I'm going to put money in this direction.
Exactly.
I think a lot of it, honestly, does come down to, as we were saying before, the idea of we want to maintain our financial prowess. We want to maintain our holdings on resources and ultimately uphold their influence.
Right, and, of course, the vision. The transhumanist vision that you actually just alluded to, that, you know, there's going to be, there are these super elite people who deserve to have, you know,
eternal life, right.
And they're going to be free. And then you have, unfortunately, you know, 5 other billion people that you got to figure out what to do with.
Well, you're the fuel cell, right? You're the fuel cell for the machine. If you are a member of the global Lao Beijing, the global deplorables.
Correct.
And then this is how they institute Elysium, right? This is what a lot of sci-fi got this wrong, is that, you know, they implement it, but then there isn't an uprising,
right?
Because you're too busy being distracted by whatever get your latest download of Neuralink, get your latest download of Zuckerberg's
right.
2.0. This is, and you know, I watch Ready Player One, and I look at it, and you know, the Oasis is what they call it in that, and I say, you know, this seems interesting, but also terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And at the end, have you seen it or read the book?
Oh,
and,
wow.
Well, so that's what it's all about. But, you know, it's like, it's all altruistic, and the guy who did it is like this huge 80s gamer kind of guy. And so you have to, in order to find your legacy in the game, you have to have memorized all of the John Hughes movies. And then like each John Hughes movie is like a level of the game as you go through. And then the player who finds all the clues becomes, I'm like, you know, and there's 80s video games references and stuff, becomes like the inheritor of the company, and then you control the Oasis. Yeah, that's not what it's going to be like.
No, that's not what it's going to be like.
No, that's not what it's going to be like
your,
at all.
Because it all comes back to those stock trades being the new big financial current.
Right.
And so your behavior becomes the data they need so that they can predict what those good stock trades are versus bad stock trades. So you're downloading the next Zuckerverse, and what are you going to go do in that? And they're going to predict, you're going to, oh, this, that, the other thing. That's the kind of things people want to do. That's the kind of behavior, feeding that into AI to make what kind of trades are going to be most relevant for what they're going to want to do to keep moving their financial interests.
Well, and so
along.
In the second one of these, the second book, and to be clear, by the way, in the first book, the protagonist does live in a giant trailer park.
Oh,
so
right.
I think that part's pretty accurate. Yeah, but
yeah.
They call it the stacks because they're actually stacked trailers.
Stacked on, well,
yeah.
Like cells, like little cubicles
or whatever, you get to live in
100 square.
But actually, that'll just be everywhere. That'll be everywhere except for the various nodes of Elysium. But in terms of the second book that you call it, Ready Player 2, it becomes, so they combine AI and Neuralink with the Oasis. And then so it's kind of like, you know how we have, you know, viral videos now,
yeah.
Or, oh, did you see this thing on YouTube? You know, my son and I just watched this thing on YouTube the other day where it was it's an elephant, like a baby elephant, going to drink some water at like a watering hole, and an alligator just comes up and snaps him in the nose, or in the trunk, right?
Yeah.
And then all the other elephants come over and just stomp the alligator.
Yeah.
We probably watched it 35 times in a row, right? And we loved it. It's my 3-year-old and me, but whatever, I'm a 3-year-old in some ways.
Yeah.
So the idea of having a viral video, what they have now through, you know, their version of whatever Neuralink is, viral memories.
Yes.
So you are essentially, you know, anyone has an experience, has a memory. Oh, and of course, in this one, you know, it gets into some of the adult stuff, obviously, you know, experience this way, experience that way. But then, oh, do you want to be Tom Brady winning the World Series? And, you know, boom, now you're beamed into the helmet, and you can smell the sweat and feel the, you know, the grass of the, you know. But I look at that and I'm thinking about, okay, this is where people are going, but that's not what it's going to be used for. That's not at all what it's going to be used for. It's going to be used for control, and then it's going to be used for war very, very quickly.
Exactly. It's a total removal of cognitive liberty.
Yes.
So your freedom of speech can be preserved too, right?
Yeah, right.
You can
say
whatever you want, but we're going to control how you think before you can speak. And it's total control, absolute control, to keep you absolutely servile. And it'll probably feel great. You will own nothing and be happy, right?
Oh, yeah. You'll be able to download, you know, whatever. Oh, did you watch, did you do this sim yet? Have you gone in that sim? Have you been in here? You know, we're just trading that back and forth. And then cognitively, we will, you know, our lizard brains won't know that we've not actually had that experience.
Exactly.
Because we will feel, it will be complete sensory immersion. So you will feel through this that you've actually had that experience, which is terrifying, right?
Right.
It should be terrifying to so many people.
Well, I mean, it's real easy to picture the upside to that, right?
Right.
But then they need to torture you for some reason.
Right, exactly.
Imagine which experiences are
going to
happen.
This is what I always tell people, though, is I say, oh, that sounds amazing, and you know, think about for, you know, people who are, you know, coma patients or people who are handicapped to be able to experience, you know, walking on a beach, et cetera. And, of course, that's how they sell it, right?
Yeah.
But then what I always tell people is, I say, okay, that's what you believe, but Mark Zuckerberg's going to be in control of
it. That's right. And Mark Zuckerberg keeps a piece of tape over the camera on his laptop. Why? Because how are you going to turn it off?
Right.
Even Mark Zuckerberg knows he can't turn and control his own camera on his laptop.
Right.
So how are you going to turn it off?
James Comey, too, by the way. Did you see that one?
Yeah.
James Comey, head of the FBI. Peace. And I actually remember reading that Bill Gates doesn't have, like, a computer in his house.
I think I remember reading that, too.
Or something. And he, like, limits the time that he wanted his kids to be on computers and all this stuff. That, no, he shouldn't have this stuff around.
Yeah.
But
no
kidding. There's something to be said for that. The same way there's something to be said for the fact that Bill Gates is going around buying up all the food-producing land ahead of inflation because he knows what's going on. And the people managing his money understand what's going on. That's what you're going to need going forward because they understand what they're doing to the money market.
Right.
So my question is, what do we do? Exactly.
Well, when you put it that way, it's a very hard question, but the answer...
What does James Lindsay say we do?
Sit strongly and tell the truth.
Basically.
That's my usual MO. What has to happen is a lot of people need to catch on. I hate to use it, but to wake up to what's actually going on in the world. And they have to start saying, no, we're not going to go down this road. If we have politicians that want to push us down this road, we get rid of those politicians. We find politicians who want to break up things like the World Economic Forum. Start shattering that thing.
I love it.
Start taking it apart. But what that requires is putting people in power who understand the problem, who are willing to get there, and that starts with a bunch of people. If it means taking to the streets, hopefully it doesn't, but if it means taking to the streets, it means taking to the streets and saying, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're going to remove you from power if you're even somewhat soft on this, if you waver on this. We're going to retain our freedom as a top priority, and it's going to require starting to attack these entities in ways where power can be leveraged against them through people who are willing to use those levers of power effectively.
One thing that I always tell, and I was speaking to an influencer kind of like internal thing here, and I got a similar question, and I said, you know, yes, saying no and stepping up, but also embrace life.
Oh, yes,
just embrace
absolutely.
Life in its fullness. Get married. Have kids.
That's right.
Go out there. Eat healthy. Stop eating the fake food, the fake nutrition that they pour down on us. Go down, understand what's in your food, understand what you're putting in your body. You know, don't live, you know, the pharmaceuticals that they're trying to just completely get you. And you look at Zoomers right now, they are the most, I think percentage-wise, the most pharmacized generation that we have seen.
It's unbelievable.
Going forward. It's unbelievable. And they all have a therapist, they're all on something or other. And probably not, you know, we're here at Turning Point AmFest. Probably not in these Zoomers,
right.
but by and large. And this is what you need to cut off from.
Exactly.
Because you need to understand that you have to be ready. Look, prepare the child for the path. Don't prepare the path for the child.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And
right.
So we have to understand, yeah, life is going to be hard. And I have kids, and I always say this, like, so we live, where we live now, it's on a lake. And I have a back gate, and I keep it locked. My kids are 3 and 1, right? You know, they don't know up from down. And so I keep the gate locked. But someday my kid's going to understand how to unlock that gate.
Right.
And he's going to understand. So then what do I do? Do I build, you know, a wall around the lake? Do I, you know, continue to, you know, do I put up signs about how you shouldn't go there? Do I scream at him and yell and yell? Or do I teach him how to swim?
Of course. Yeah, this is key to exactly like you said. Another very crucial piece is that, especially for a younger generation, needs to start to understand very quickly that real life, and very resonant with what you said, real life is what happens when you're not online.
Yes.
And real life is worth living, even though it's not ideal and you're not getting to be Tom Brady winning the Super Bowl or whatever it happens to be in some fake memory that was never yours in the first place. Real life has actually got its own charm. And it's what happens when you're online.
That is why they want to put you in passive mode. That's why they want you hooked on, oh, what actor is going to be cast in the next Marvel, the Netflix series that's coming out, the adaptation? Are they gender swapping this? Are they race swapping that? And they want you just so caught up in all of that because they don't want you to be leaning in, living active lives. And I don't mean active in just the physical sense, but actually embracing life in all of its fullness.
Right.
And deciding that I'm going to be someone who I'm going to be doing so much in my life that I don't even have time. I don't have time to look at those things because I'm going out, I'm meeting people,
right.
I'm making connections, I'm raising my kids, we're having real experiences in the real world, we're living the life that we can live.
If they pay attention now, they'll realize it's dissatisfying. You're a little bit bummed, you're a little bit bored.
And are they all anxious? Why are they all depressed? Why are they all on the therapist couch?
And it will not meet your need. You get on your video game and you're going to have fun. You can blow off some steam. You can kill some time, but it's not going to meet your need. You know, I quit playing video games completely in about 2007 or 8. I was playing World of Warcraft. I was quite into it.
I couldn't even tell you last time I played a video game.
And I was grinding my character up. And I thought to myself one day, it just popped into my head. You know, it's like one of those things. I didn't ask for it. It just showed up. And I thought, wow, I'm putting a lot of effort into making this avatar of myself awesome when I could be making myself better with this time.
Right.
And half an hour later, video games stopped being interesting to me. I've never played one again except as a nostalgia with, like, you know, get the guys together and we play through the game we played when we were a kid over, like, Christmas. But other than that...
Is it GoldenEye?
No, it was Myth.
I remember Myth. Yeah, wow.
Yeah. We did Myst and we did also Secret of Mana, the old Nintendo.
Yeah,
Super Nintendo.
Yeah, super old.
Yeah, I love Secret of Mana. That was fun. The three player.
There's something, by the way, about those games where it's you can turn them off.
Exactly.
Right?
Something
I've noticed this, by the way, with my kid as well, that when we watch like older, you know, TV shows, stuff from 80s, 90s or before, you know, he can sort of unglue himself and go off and do something else. But you put on one of these newer shows with the flashing lights and the really, really bright colors, he is just plugged in. He's so plugged in.
Well, they figured out, from what I understand, they figured out exactly how often they have to change a scene or put a flash or a bright color.
That's exactly right.
That actually, like, it resets your attention span.
Correct.
So your attention span never shuts down.
Right.
I bet you it's the exact same pace. If you're sitting there bored one night, you don't have anything to do, guilty, mea culpa, and you're on Twitter and you're just like, you pull your
who
pull
goes
your finger
on
down
Twitter? What are you using on Twitter for, James Lindsay?
We're never on Twitter.com. You're bored
website.
And you're sitting
no
there and you hit the refresh and nothing's there and you hit the refresh again. I bet you it's the exact same pacing.
Get out of my head,
James
Lindsay.
I bet you
that's
Lindsay.
How they
figured
out
what that pacing is.
Those are my thoughts. Stay out of there.
Oh,
that's,
no.
You know, that's exactly.
Well,
when
you're
I hit the refresh,
king of Twitter, so I'm the
when
jack.
I hit, you are the jack. Yeah. When I hit the refresh and there's nothing new, I'm like, well, now what do I do?
Yeah. Right. Where are my people?
No, and that's for me. And look, there's a lot worse addictions to have out there, but you know, when it comes to Twitter, that's something where I do view it as a fight, and I'm naturally contrarian and argumentative, and it is the perfect trap for me mentally.
Me too. It's my arena.
Exactly. Right. And Tim Pool had a great line about this. You know, he was talking about YouTube, but he said, because people say, oh, what are you still using that for? That's the bad guy's platform. I said, I'm not going to get off the battlefield because the battlefield is dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You know, so I'm going to stay. But at the same time, you know, I do have to step back and say, you know what? This is some person online that I'm never going to see in real life.
Yeah.
That's never going to have an effect on me. But I've got two little boys over here, and I've got a wife, and I've got a house. And they need my attention more, and they matter more, and
exactly.
They are going to go on long after I've punched my ticket and I'm out.
Yeah.
And the minute I start thinking about that, I don't even think about the phone anymore.
It's irrelevant. And then you hit this point a few minutes later, it's like, why do I even do that? You don't even want to.
So the difference is, I think, and we're getting close to the end of our time here, so I would just say, live a life worth living.
Yeah, that's it. That's the answer. Live also the life they don't want you to live.
Right.
Right? Yeah, they don't want right. you to have
you,
faith.
You don't
faith.
Have. You don't have to have family. You don't have to have the 9 to 5. You don't need to be a cog. You don't need to be just a part of the machine, commuting back and forth. You know. And this is actually why, in some ways, like the Great Resignation is that another silver lining of COVID that I embrace, because a lot of people step back and look at their lives and said, why am I doing that? Why am I driving an hour to work, chaining myself to a desk, 9 to 5? And this is both genders, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Driving an hour back, come home, you know, traffic sucks, I'm crabby, you know, I'm upset, I barely spend any time with my kids, you snap at them. Not me, by the way.
No, never. And, but you get it out on your
never,
staff.
Never, I get it on my staff, yeah, of course. That's what they're there for. And they said, you know, maybe there's a better way. Maybe I can do freelancing. Maybe Fiverr.com is a way to do it. Maybe podcasting. Maybe start something else.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many ways to make money. We've got Morgan Zegers here. She makes American flags out of wood and sells them on Instagram.
That's awesome.
And, like, she literally just, she talks about this, but she said she paid off all of her student loans by doing that.
That's amazing.
So, you know, why not do that?
Yeah, and good for her.
Another big thing with Turning Point, and Charlie talks about it a lot, is why go? Why go to college in the first place?
Yeah.
If we have all of these tools right now, if the information is out, at least for now, you can go and get it. What do you, it's like, you know, the Wright brothers were high school dropouts.
Yeah, exactly. And what did we just see in the Olympics, where the Indian guy trained himself watching YouTube videos to throw javelins and won the gold medal?
Yeah.
Using YouTube.
Exactly.
That was his trainer, YouTube.
Exactly. This is a problem for a lot of these systems. James, we are getting close to the end of our time. This is actually a really good interview, and it did end up being more substantive than I thought it would be. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
thank you.
Where can people go to follow you? What do you want to promote?
I got at Conceptual James on Twitter and other social media mirroring it. At New Discourses is the company. NewDiscourses.com is the website. I got a book coming hopefully next month. It's in the typesetting process now. It's going to be called Race Marxism. It's going to explain exactly what the title says about critical race theory. So
yes, perfect.
It's all in the works. That's what you got to check out.
Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, the great James Lindsay. Make sure you, and I always tell everybody, everywhere homework is to share this out with one normie friend. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, you have my permission to lay ashore.